UFOs? Are they aliens? Government secret projects? The imaginings of disturbed individuals? Or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters.
Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. Now, on our programs, we have a wide variety of views that are expressed, some from people who have definitely the non-traditional view, the non-mainstream view, those who believe that E.T. has possibly visited here and done all sorts of things in our skies and on our land. But you have a huge percentage of scholars who are in the other camp, the camp, the traditional view, that is not the case. But that does not mean that there isn't a hunt for alien life. And there certainly is with the gentleman we're going to speak with today. He is the author of the new book, The Hunt for Alien Life, A Wider Perspective. I'm talking about Dr. Peter Linde. He is joining us today from Sweden. He has been fascinated by astronomy since childhood and is involved in many projects that convey this commitment in popular science form. Previously, he worked as an assistant professor in astronomy at Lund University, Sweden. As a researcher, he has been active in advanced analysis of astronomical imagery, participating in studies of solar-type stars and stellar populations in nearby galaxies. Recently, he has been engaged in simulations, and this is very interesting. I want to hear more about this, for the European Extremely Large Telescope, which is now being built. Dr. Peter Linde, welcome to the program today.
Thank you.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I think that we tend to be prisoners of the moment, so to speak. We think that we're the only era that really looked to the heavens for signs of life, but it goes far, far back, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, astronomy has always taken a great place, I think, in all humans' life, especially perhaps previously, in the way that then it was so easy to see the sky. I believe today, many people live in cities in a way that they actually never see a really dark sky. And if you see a dark sky, I believe that you can sense a lot of interesting feelings.
Now,
including, yes, I mean, the infinity aspect when you're looking out there on the stars, I mean, many questions arise simply.
When we talk about astronomy, talk to us about the evolution of technology. I mean, going back to the very, very early days with the invention of the telescope, but really there's been a revolution. I would guess, being a layperson, it seems to me, just viewing it from the outside in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been an absolute revolution. Can you talk to us a little bit about the evolution of the technology?
Yeah. I mean, in the 80s, when I did my first observations, the CCD camera, as it was called, was introduced in professional astronomy. Now it is widely used also in amateur astronomy. And that was in itself a revolution in terms of detectors. Suddenly you could detect 100 times more light than you could previously with photographic techniques. And since then, what you can do is to build larger and larger telescopes, because you already can detect all the photons. So you need to have a larger mirror. And now we are in the decade where the extremely large telescopes will be built, and that will be another fantastic revolution. At the same time, in radio astronomy, you do marvelous things and build new very, very large telescopes, radio telescopes that look at the radio sky. You have the ALMA project down in northern Chile, for instance, which is a worldwide collaboration. So all these things together are incredible. It's a golden age for astronomers, I would say.
Now, in your bio, we talked about the European Extremely Large Telescope. Tell us about that. What for those of us who are maybe just heard of it, not familiar with it, tell us, is it land-based? Is it space-based? What are we talking about here?
Well, it's a land-based telescope, and when ready, it will be the world's largest, having a composite mirror of a diameter of 39 meters. Composite means that it's made up by hexagonal segments, and they are all going to work together as if it was a single mirror. The location of this observatory will also be in Chile, in northern Chile, where Europe already has some other large installations. So it will be totally amazing, because being a ground-based instrument, it needs to combat what we call the turbulence in the atmosphere. And that can be done by very sophisticated technology known as adaptive optics. So this telescope will be equipped with adaptive optics, giving it resolution, so to speak, sharpness in images that will surpass, for instance, the Hubble Space Telescope's. Wow. Many times, yes.
So it will actually, being land-based, it will be able to overcome that. And I've got to believe that much of this revolution, along with improved optics and these sorts of things, has been tremendously aided by computerization over the last several decades.
That's right. And in this case, and that's where I have been involved myself a little bit, you have to simulate everything in advance. In order to make sure that it's really possible to construct it. So I have been involved in a project where the whole telescope was simulated, in including dynamical things like air turbulence and motion of the mirrors and everything. And once you can do that in a convincing way, it's also possible to get the funding for the project. Of course, you also need to find out what you can use it for, and the reasons behind that are often decisive to get the funding from governments or whatever you get them. In this case, the search for exoplanets and possibly life on such an exoplanet is a driving force in order to motivate such very large investments.
In terms of astronomy and the hunt for alien life, has there been, would it be, and maybe it's not, is it accurate to say maybe there's been a paradigm shift in the last several decades in that, just again, as a layperson, reading the popular literature, it seems that there seems to be more of a willingness to accept the idea that there might be life beyond, with the discovery of all these thousands of exoplanets, and maybe we should talk about exoplanets, what they are a little bit. But do you think that there's a shift from maybe the possibility now to the probability of alien life somewhere out there?
Yes, Jim, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think there has been a paradigm shift, mainly driven by these rapid discoveries of new planets around other stars. And now, I mean, I saw today that the latest figure is 2,074 exoplanets. So the whole discussion is now in a new light, so to speak, of where to find life. I would say that most scientists would agree to the high probability that life exists elsewhere. Then what kind of life, of course, is a quite different matter.
And that's a good point. When we say life on other planets, I think as lay people, we tend to jump right to the conclusion that you've got bipedal creatures that are somewhat humanoid and like us. There could be life without it being intelligent life or sophisticated life, correct?
Yes, I think that is also what the majority would assume. So far, we don't know of any other planet with life, but I believe we will find such planets within a decade or two in different ways, but probably with a very low level of life, bacterial, single-cellular life, that kind of thing. We don't know why life evolved as it did here on Earth, and we have the problem of the so-called Fermi paradox, which tells us that there should be a lot of intelligences out there, but we don't see any traces of them. So, and that's one of the arguments in favor of, okay, there is life, but it's probably on a very low, primitive level.
We've kind of thrown around the topic exoplanets. Maybe some people aren't familiar with that. What is an exoplanet and why are they important?
Yeah, well, as you know, our planetary system has the sun in the middle, and we have eight major planets around it going in orbits. There are a lot of smaller planets, by the way, but eight major planets. Now, in 1995, the first discovery of a planet orbiting another star of similar to the sun was made. And that is then known as an exoplanet. So an exoplanet is a planet orbiting another star, not our sun. So they are very far away, evidently. And now, as I said, we have discovered, the astronomers have discovered a couple of thousands of them already since 1995. And that is an incredible development, in fact. And a lot of the professional astronomy now is focused on this type of scientific studies.
Earth, when we think about Earth, I think that we've, for probably a long part of history, felt that there's kind of a unique cocktail to support life here. Now, with the discovery of these exoplanets, isn't it true that other, quote, Earth-like planets have been found that might have a similar mix?
I believe it. Well, if they haven't been found, they certainly will be found. The NASA satellite, the Kepler satellite, is one of the major players here and has in itself made more than 1,000 of these new discoveries. And a few of these seems to be possibly similar to the Earth. The problem here is that in many of these discoveries, you can decide the orbital period for such a planet. You can decide on its size. But you cannot, with Kepler satellite, for instance, decide on its mass. And that means that you cannot really characterize the planet, saying that it's an Earth-like planet. It could be what we also call a gas-type planet. So although we see very beautiful drawings made by artists whenever such discoveries are made, and so they publish these things, but we have to keep in mind that we have very, very little detailed information so far about these exoplanets. But yes, already there are a few found in what is known as the habitable zone, where the planet should be in order to have a sufficient radiation income from its star, so that it's not too hot or not too cold.
When we do these programs, many times we have people on who talk about interplanetary travel and assume that they're intelligent beings out there zipping around the stars. One thing that might get lost in that kind of speculation, and I'm not saying it's right or it's wrong, but are the vast distances that we are talking about between these solar systems and these bodies and so forth. Can you give us some sense of the kind of distances we're talking about when we talk about something like an exoplanet?
Well, to begin with, if we look in our own planetary system or solar system, I tend to try to use a yardstick in terms of light traveling time. And many people have heard about light years, which is, of course, the distance that the light will traverse in a year, and it's an extremely long distance. The distance from the Earth to the Moon is one light second, while in our planetary system, we're talking about light hours, so to speak, in this context. Now, the nearest star is 4 light years away. And for many of these discoveries, these exoplanet discoveries, those stars, those host stars are much further away than that, typically between, let's say, 10 to 1,000 light years. So we are talking about enormous distances. And also for radio-type communication, if there would be any, it will take a long time for such signals to reach to us or to reach to anybody out there.
Well, that's something I've read since I was a kid, and it's always fascinated me, the idea that if somebody out there is listening, for example, to our broadcasts or our, whether they be television, radio, whatever they might be, that there's such a lag that if they could even determine something, it would be decades old. So maybe it's the programs of the radio programs of the 40s or the 50s that they're tuning into, not the ones today. Is that accurate, or is that a misnomer?
Well, I have tried to look into that in some detail, and it's not easy to actually do the exact computations here. What we are talking about are two different things. If we look at our own transmissions from the Earth, you can think in terms of this leakage transmission that would in principle be isotropic. It means that it would radiate from the Earth in all directions at the same time. They are not directed then. that kind of radiation gets very, very thin very, very quickly. I tried to estimate that, and already at out close to our own planetary system, that signal would be so extremely weak that even a super civilization would have great difficulty to make anything out of it. The other type is whether there are directed signals that we have transmitted from the Earth, some such directed transmissions using larger radio telescopes. And such signals will penetrate very far away, and they can be detected at the other end, if there is anyone listening, of course.
Well, that brings about something that I've always been fascinated about. Can you talk a little bit about the WOW signal, what it was, how it was collected, and its significance?
Well, this was in the 70s, and it was a rather large radio telescope, which was operated more or less automatically. And at that time, there were not much of a sophisticated computer storage thing. So what happened was that the telescope was observing, and it gave some output on a paper. And it was not really checked until rather much later, when Jerry Amon was one of the people working with this, actually looked on that sheet of paper, and he then saw that at some point there had been a very, very large signal coming into the telescope. Mm-hmm. And so people became very, very excited about this, of course, and they tried to understand what kind of signal this was. Could it be explained by any earthly phenomena, which they usually are? But as far as I can see from the literature, they actually never did find any source that explained this away. So it's still unexplained what that kind of information was, or that radio pulse was. It had no time resolution in the sense that the telescope could not resolve it in time, so it's not known whether there was any information inside that transmission that was received. So whether it actually came from the sky of some other, possibly civilization, it has never been established, obviously. And of course, that particular point in the sky has been reobserved many, many times, and nothing has ever been seen again from the same point on the sky, unfortunately, I would say.
When you look at it, it would seem to me that there are several possibilities, and I'm sure I'm discounting some, but some natural occurring phenomena, some kind of equipment glitch. I wouldn't say computer glitch, because you'd mentioned that they're weren't heavily involved in computers at that time, but some kind of equipment glitch, possibly, maybe some kind of natural occurring phenomena. And then the more interesting one is some kind of signal intentionally or unintentionally sent by some kind of intentional life there. Are those the main categories of possibilities that have been examined?
I would agree, yes. That's as far as I know. And I read Jerry Amon's own report on this, and at least he was not could not see how it could be explained by any more nearby phenomena, so to speak. So it is still an open question. If you would like to speculate, and I sometimes speculate, but try to do it scientifically, you could possibly compare this signal, this observation, to what we ourselves did in terms of sending a message with the Arecibo telescope, also in the 1970s. Which was a single message, 3 minutes long, directed to a global cluster, as we call it, and it was never repeated. So it could possibly have been some kind of direct transmission from somewhere out there, but we will never know that, I'm sure. But as you know, the search for signals are very serious and are being done all the time.
Talk to us about radio telescopes. What do you think their role is as opposed to optical telescopes, whether they be land-based or space-based? What do they bring us maybe that the optical telescopes do not?
You mean in terms of possible communication?
Yes.
Well, it's not difficult to establish that radio transmissions, whatever you think, it is probably the most simple way to do communication. In the case of optical signals, we're talking then about laser transmissions. They are very, very directed in nature. And if such communications are taking place out there, they will really have to be directed directly towards the Earth in order to for us to see anything. All this depends on what you think is behind the signals. If there is somewhere civilization, again, speculation, of course, who would like to transmit information about themselves in order for others to receive it, then I would think that they would try to use a reasonably simple and effective means of doing that. And radio waves are still, I think, the best option there. And in that case, we are talking about what is known as beacon transmitters, which are really made in order to actually transmit something to some other civilization. So we're not just talking about random communication messages. But we haven't seen any of those so far.
The book, The Hunt for Alien Life, A Wider Perspective. There are so many books out there about alien life that don't come from a traditionally scientific perspective. So I'm guessing that's part of the reason for wanting to do this book. What did you hope to achieve by releasing it?
Well, as a professional astronomer, I have always been very interested in trying to popularize the subject. And I've been doing that in parallel for my whole life, more or less. And I feel there are such interesting things, interesting values within the science of astronomy that I believe it would be very nice if more people were made aware of. And in this particular case, with this book, you had this enormous explosion of exoplanet discoveries, which made this an even more interesting topic, as we just discussed, makes it more interesting to discuss whether there are possibly life somewhere else. And I think all these questions are very fundamental. And if I in some way can contribute to increased awareness around these questions, I think that would be very, very valuable.
What do you think the most common misconceptions about astronomy and the search for alien life are, in your view? What does the layperson generally get wrong? Not maliciously, but just something they don't understand.
Well, we are, I mean, again, this is what I would think. We're talking about this, then we're speculating a little bit, and it's also a little bit outside my field. But I think there are a couple of things that are noteworthy to mention. For instance, for any other civilization to notice our civilization, they should then evidently have picked up, however difficult it is, any kind of transmission from us in order to notice that there is some intelligent life on Earth. Now, these transmissions that we have made, whether possible to detect or not, have lasted for about 100 years. So the maximum distance that any information from Earth can have traveled so far is within this bubble of a radius of 100 light years. And if you compare that, which I have done on my website for the book, for instance, to the size of the Milky Way, I mean, we're talking about 200 light years compared to 100,000 light years, which is the radius of the Milky Way, or the diameter, sorry. And okay, there are stars within this 200 light years volume, but that there would be any civilization there is very, very small probability, I would think, and that they would send some ships to Earth is even more improbable. So that's one aspect I believe is overseen quite a lot, that we are not as visible as people might think. The other thing is that in this age of having access to millions of cameras, I mean, every person today has a mobile phone with a camera. I would expect many, many, many more witnesses and evidences from things seen in the sky than at least I have seen. I may be looking at the wrong web pages, but these are a couple of things that I believe are not considered too much.
And I've done my level best to keep this on mainstream science, but I do have to ask, what is your opinion of those who say, well, you know, there's all of this, these UFOs that have been flying around since 1947. We have photographs and video, and we believe that you know, we're way past the part of discovering alien life in the skies, but it's already been here. Do you have an opinion on that? And I'll leave that portion of it just to your opinion on that thought process.
Well, I don't believe that they exist in our neighborhood. I have not looked into that subject very, very thoroughly myself, so I'm certainly no expert on it. A general comment on that is that, of course, there are observations that are valid. I do not deny that, although I haven't looked into them myself very much. Reliable observations, so they have to be explained in some way. However, I lack the scientific approach to some extent here. I would think that if there was really something in this, it would interest the scientists enormously, and it would be the evident candidate for a Nobel Prize to have established that we have intelligences in our neighborhood. But none of this is happening. So there is something to be learned from that, I believe. But again, I'm no expert on this field, and certainly I agree that there are observations made that are not easily explained.
In terms of an astronomer talking, if something like this were to be found, you know, people like Hawking have said, if there is intelligent life out there, specifically if they're able to travel here, we probably want no part of them, because by definition, if they were able to travel here, they would be technologically advanced. And throughout history, we have seen here on Earth what happens to technologically inferior societies when they are confronted with a technologically superior society. And it usually does not end well. I can't even think of a case where it's ended well for the inferior in terms of technology civilization. So that being said, as an astronomer, does the idea of intelligent life elsewhere, does it excite you? Does it frighten you? What are your thoughts?
That's a very interesting question. I think it's also a personal question, so to speak. When I talk to other astronomers, these topics are not all necessarily discussed. I mean, so I also have the same questions sometimes to my colleagues. What do they feel about these things? And it's not very much discussed, unfortunately. As I said, I believe definitely that the primitive life is very, very probable, and that we will detect it in a couple of decades. Personally, I would see very favorably on the prospect of actually detecting something, some signal from out there that is intelligent. I think it would be a momentous occasion. It would be a historic occasion, could be extremely important for mankind. Because, I mean, one aspect here is the fact that if you actually receive an intelligence signal from somewhere, probably then directed toward us, that would mean that there is a probably much more advanced civilization than ours somewhere out there. It could even be, I mean, this could be tens of thousands of light years away in principle, or even more. It could be from a different galaxy even. And that would give us hope. I mean, because we don't really know how long our own civilization will survive. If we find that there are some super civilization somewhere out there, at least it would mean to us is the fact that somebody else made it. They actually became super civilization. If there is ever going to be any intercommunication between us and them, that might be very much less probable. The threat of having an armada of spaceships coming against us is probably very, very small. But again, we are talking about distances that are long. And if someone would be hostile, it would probably take hundreds of years before they actually could arrive here. So it is a philosophical question to some extent, and I believe astronomers have different views on whether it is a good or bad thing. As you said, Stephen Hawking is very cautious here, and there are others who think that we should not just transmit messages that some people are doing, directing them to the newly discovered exoplanets, because it may be irresponsible to do so. We don't know what will happen if there is someone receiving and how they will react. And I would agree with that, because should we do these kinds of transmissions, they should be in some way officially acknowledged. Perhaps the United Nations or somewhere else should do these kinds of things, not like commercial enterprises, which are currently sometimes doing this. And so there should be some kind of responsibility there. Yes.
And here's I'm sorry, I know you're not a philosopher, but I do like to get these opinions from scientists and get their views on these things. The question of manned spaceflight. Certainly, we know that the moon landings happened in 1969 and subsequently in the early 70s, and then really nothing in terms of putting man onto any type of ground out there in space. And many people have said, well, that's ridiculous. I mean, we're talking about 46 years ago. Well, obviously the Apollo continued through the early 70s, but over 40 years ago. So my question is this. I mean, there's so much we can do with technology, whether it's radio telescopes, whether it's land-based optical telescopes, whether it's space-based telescopes, whether it's probes going out into space, like the Mars probe. There's so many things that could be done by remote control. In your view, do you think it's also important to have manned space flight and manned exploration in addition to all of these technological extensions of mankind?
Yes, I do. In fact, I think it's absolutely necessary. And for a couple of reasons. I mean, if you notice, if you compare the interest in media between the manned moon landings and what has happened since then, it's a gigantic difference. If you can really engage a lot of interest in from humanity, then you can do much more than you can do if it's just for purely scientific reasons. So I think there are psychological reasons, if nothing else, that you need to have manned space flights, because that's the way you get the support from the general public in terms of interest. And I think that will be even more important in the future. Because if you don't have that kind of interest, you will not get the funding anyway, because the governments will not be providing it. So I think these things go together. And in fact, if you sometimes in the far future will undertake a voyage to another star, I believe it should also be manned in some way. Although such a project so far is more or less nothing but science fiction. But the human aspect here is absolutely fundamental, yes.
Well, it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. I have enjoyed it. Getting a different perspective, a wider perspective, if you will, The Hunt for Alien Life. The author is Dr. Peter Linda. Dr. Linda, where can people find more information about your work? I know you have a website, and also where can they find the book?
Well, yes, the book is sold by Springer, and I think also by Amazon.com. And I've seen it on Google. Some pages are being published there. And then I have this website for the book itself called peterlinda.net, Peter Linda in a single word. And there is an English version now that I'm trying to update and upgrade. So any listener is quite welcome to look into that page. And, of course, to buy the book, which is an excellent book.
If you do say so yourself. No, I really do appreciate your time, and I appreciate a lot of traditional scientists would stray away from this kind of program, but I'm glad you took time, and I thank you for your time today all the way from Sweden.
Yes, thank you very much, Ian.
And thank you for tuning in to UFO Encounters. I hope that you will keep your eye to the sky, and I'm sure that Dr. Linda would agree. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.